when you're making MASH diets, particle size can be very important for layers versus maybe turkeys or broilers, where maybe if you use a coarser size, it's going to get pelleted, and maybe you can kind of work through that pelleting. You know, in the end, it's going to be efficient for the meat birds. But in the case of layers, you're only feeding MASH, and sometimes layers, you know, they, as the hen grows a little bit older, they can be, you know, a little picky, where they tend to choose maybe some particles they like, some coarser sizes and all, and maybe they're leaving some of the essential nutrients on the side because they're just focusing on the cores.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. bioMérieux is a world leader in the field of diagnostics for more than 60 years. From pathogen detection to genomics and data applications, bioMérieux helps poultry manufacturers going beyond the test results.
You can combat mycotoxins in your feed with Fumezyme from DSM Firmenich. Fumezyme is the only FDA-approved enzyme to degrade fumonisins.
AB Vista offers pioneering products and technical services tailored to the poultry industry to help them succeed. Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way.
Welcome to the Poultry Podcast Show. Today, I am here with Dr. Andrea Rubio. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
I'm really excited to chat with you about feed milling and efficiency, but first, I would love to hear, how did you get into poultry and the feed milling industry?
Thank you. That's it. I always like to share that because it was definitely a very interesting journey for me. It wasn't very straightforward when I was in undergrad. I was actually into ruminants and not even nutrition. I wanted to go into the. I knew I wanted to work with dairy, and be on the side of reproduction. Yeah. So I was all into dairy judging, and I was sure I was going to be working with ruminants after graduation. But then something happened with my internships, and in my senior year, I got an internship in poultry, and I had no idea what was poultry at that time. I wasn't sure. So I had the great opportunity to come to LSU, and I did a broiler management internship with Dr. Theresa Laverne. She was a faculty member at LSU at the time, and also Ariel Bergeron. She was also a senior undergrad at that time. We've been both kind of going through the same timeline as far as grad school go and all that. So I met her there. And then from that opportunity, I was able to go to IPPE, where it was a great exposure, I would say, experience, where I was able to network. And obviously, everybody knows how big of an event is IPP. It's really great for meeting people. So there I met Wilmer Pacheco, who was about to start his faculty job at Auburn University. He came in as an assistant professor. I was able to kind of network with him, and I told him I was interested in pursuing some further education. And he brought me in as a master's student in poultry science. That's how I kind of got that first real exposure with school, with classes. From there, I started working with broiler, doing and studying some interrelationships between broiler nutrition and feed manufacturing. And Dr. Wilmer was really great because obviously he had a very strong nutrition profile, and he also had feed manufacturing experience. So from there, I wanted to kind of learn a little bit more on that side. And when I was looking for a PhD, I wanted to work with Dr. Adam Farenholz, who was one of the few feed mill experts that we have. And, you know, I was lucky, I would say, that, you know, that program was housed in poultry at NC State. So I was able to join his program there, and I started my PhD, got my PhD in nutrition and poultry science, and did some nutrition work as well, and always trying to tie it up a little bit of what's happening in the feed mill level. So yeah, that's been my journey. I graduated in 2022, and I've been working as a postdoc at NC State.
a worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adiseo's portfolio of products includes methionine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adiseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adiseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adiseo at www.adiseo.com.
That's so awesome. Yeah. I love that you just fell into poultry and then ran with it. I mean, you were all in. You got a doctorate.
Yeah. I was, it was, like I said, I think IPP helped a lot because it really gave me a good glance on, you know, how the industry and the opportunities that the industry had to offer. So, you know, I was like, maybe I can find some really good professional development in this industry. So yeah, I kind of made the switch.
That's amazing. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing right now as a postdoc in terms of feed milling? Maybe you can, for people who are outside of nutrition and milling, maybe you can break down the process just a little bit so we can understand better.
Yeah. So last year I was able to publish one of the first manuscripts that was basically on mixing profiles, mixer CV. So we were interested in testing how different mix times were able to affect broiler growth. That was one of the things that I kind of started working in my PhD, and we were able to publish it. And we were doing some NIR work as well, trying to play how inline NIR can actually maybe help us to assay a little bit better mixer CV. We tried that. And I say we try because obviously we were kind of playing with the equipment. It's not obviously necessarily made for that, but we were trying to see if we could get some mixer CV and see what was happening there in real time as we are actually manufacturing diets. And then some of the things that I've been trying to kind of finish up from the PhD was that I was trying to kind of come up with a type of sensor, temperature sensor, that we always get a lot of, some of the trials that we do, we get a lot of companies that obviously have additives and have products. And obviously we know that our main concern is always the temperature, you know, how hot or how high the temperatures can get during pelleting, during conditioning. So there is not really an easy method or way that you can measure, you know, okay, we're pelleting the feed and I know exactly how hot the pellets are getting. And I know that, you know, this can impact this enzyme or this probiotic or something like that. But there is not really a specific way to do it. There's not a, I would say, an official method that we use. We very simple, you know, whenever we're measuring temperature, we just grab a insulated thermos, we grab the pellets, and then we put a thermometer in and hope that that's a good estimate of, you know, that frictional heat and any heat that we're generating while pelleting. But I started developing, it was an interesting work to do because obviously I'm not an engineering by any means. I'm not an expert, but I had to reach out to some professors in the engineering department because I was getting to the point where, you know, even Dr. Farrell, when I told him about the idea, he was really good, but he was open to try it out. And we tried to come up with this sensor that was going to be helpful, but at the same time was not going to, let's say, break the bank, you know, create something very expensive, because obviously that wasn't the point. But yeah, I kind of went through that process of developing a sensor. We were able to put it to work. We had to open a little hole in the pellet mill door. We brought welders in and all. So we were playing with that and see if that worked. The first time definitely didn't work. It's not an easy, when you're pelleting, it's not a very, I would say, friendly environment inside the pellet mill. Obviously, you have a lot of other things happening at the same time. So it was fun. The first try was definitely a no. And then from there, I actually told Dr. Farnholz, you know, I think our sensor, it's we have a good kind of basic concept, but we need to change the type of sensor. So I tried changing that, and definitely going from one sensor and changing the type, it gave a lot better data. So I'm working on actually publishing that part pretty soon, and I think that one, it's even though it's not perfect, it was definitely more I would say promising than the first try.
Yeah. Well, it's equally as important to know what doesn't work.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. With that one, I definitely learned what didn't work, but it was good. You know, I always say that's how science goes. You have to try, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
So can you point out maybe some parts of the feed milling process that are big indicators for downstream efficiency? So maybe you talked about there could be steps with heat that could reduce efficacy of some components. But, you know, if we start at the beginning, maybe you could talk about impact of particle size or anything else during the process that you think is definitely related to efficiency at the end.
Yeah, something that definitely there's a lot of recent discussions about. I know if we start in the very beginning, obviously receiving of ingredients is your first line of defense in any feed facility. So there's a lot of conversations going on about mycotoxins. So one of the first things and that we always try to, you know, to keep up on the quality side is obviously testing for mycotoxins. That's kind of one of the first starting points that we do whenever we get a lot of corn. We do that and just try to test for aflatoxins and done. And the mycotoxins of interest depending on the species. Then going into grinding, particle size, it's been one of those topics where there's a lot of research on particle size, and there are a lot of things that can go on in particle size depending on the grinding equipment that you're using, hammer mill versus roller mills, depending the type of particle size that you want to get, depending on the type of feed that you want to get. I was talking about, you know, how maybe when you're making mash diets, particle size can be very important for layers versus maybe turkeys or broilers, where maybe if you use a coarser size, it's going to get pelleted, and maybe you can kind of work through that pelleting. You know, in the end, it's going to be efficient for the meat birds. But in the case of layers, you're only feeding mash, and sometimes layers, you know, they as the hen grows a little bit older, they can be, you know, a little picky, where they tend to choose maybe some particles they like, some coarser sizes and all, and maybe they're leaving some of the essential nutrients on the side because they're just focusing on the core. So whenever we're dealing with particle size, you know, like I said, in the case of layers, a lot of feed mills or maybe nutritionists take the decision that, you know, we may use a roller mill versus a hammer mill because roller mills tend to give a particle size that is a little more uniform. So that can be a lot more beneficial in terms of performance for layers than, you know, meat birds, where you're obviously further pelleting that feed. Now, in the case of meat birds, when we talk about particle size, we're always talk about fine versus coarse. I did an interesting study during my master's that we were kind of focusing on particle size and the age of the bird, because we're always talking about, you know, in meat birds, it's really important to stimulate the geysers. So you maybe want to go a little coarser than feeding just fine corn particle size. So we did try to kind of focus on the age of the birds, and it was very interesting because we were kind of nervous to see, because we were at some point in one of the studies, we were trying to feed a coarser size to bird when they were in the starter period. So we thought, you know, maybe they will not be able to just eat it because they're baby chicks. So are they going to consume something that is, you know, coarser than 1,000 microns? So, but they, to our surprise, they were able to definitely eat that. So we know they can eat it. But then as we were going through the grower and the finisher, if you go maybe too coarse on younger birds, you may be overstimulating the geese. So by the time they grow and you are trying to feed something coarser, maybe you lose the benefits of a coarser side, because then those particles are just going through the track and they're not, you know, stimulating the geese or as we wanted to. So that was something interesting to see. Definitely, we saw that some effects on the finisher period. So, you know, in conclusions for those type of study, we're like, you know, we can maybe go a little bit on the median size as far as the studies that we did, maybe 600, 700 when they're younger. And as they grow older, we can definitely go maybe a little coarser, a little closer to 800, 900 microns and having some savings in the grinding process, because that's kind of the goal, save a little bit of energy and, you know, not having that grinding equipment to work as much as you wanted to with a finer size. So we're kind of playing with that in terms of particle size. And then moving into the mixing, some of the things that I was doing with my PhD was definitely, like I mentioned earlier, was mixer CV and uniformity. That was something interesting to navigate in our current system, because obviously we are thought, you know, a variation of 10% in the mixer, if you have a variation of 10% or less, you have a good uniformity, your diet looks good, it should be all good. So in that specific part of the studies, we were trying to actually test the standard time that we mix feed, which is around 5 minutes total. But we were also trying to test to mix the feed only for 30 seconds. So we were trying to really make a really bad mix intentionally.
Yeah.
And feed that directly to the birds. And, you know, and one of the, when we were making that feed, actually, there was one nutritionist with us that day, JT Pope. He was there. And when he was watching us make that feed, we were asking JT, hey, JT, do you think the birds are gonna be good with this mixing? And JT was like, I don't think so. I mean, we're barely mixing it. We're intentionally trying to make something that is not uniform and see what happens to the birds. And to our surprise, with that specific study, we just fed mash. We didn't fed pellets, because we wanted to see that direct impact that a non-uniform mash would have in broilers in the birds, and see if, you know, maybe we're mixing actually has a really bad impact on their performance. But it was very surprising, because we did not find any differences at all, not even we were hoping that, you know, maybe young birds were affected by that non-uniform mix a little bit more than the older birds were, but yeah, when we saw the results, I think we were all very surprised that we didn't find any differences in there. But you know, like I said, it was interesting to see also that there's some potential and I would say opportunity to maybe not necessarily saying that. And I always try to make the point that we're not saying, you know what, you can go ahead and just mix the feed for 30 seconds, because
no.
Obviously you don't want to do that. But there's definitely some opportunity to slightly reduce some of the mix time and, you know, be a little bit more efficient, especially for feed mills. They can slightly reduce the time and not having a negative impact on the birds, especially when they're maybe older. You don't want to do it for younger birds, but maybe there's an opportunity definitely for the older birds.
Yeah. Coming from the new nutrition thought process, that just terrifies me to only mix for 30 seconds. Like, conceptually, that's difficult for me to want to do.
yeah, definitely. Especially if you're making medicated feed, where you're adding, you know, very, very small amounts of medications, or even if you're adding, you know, an enzyme that it's also going in definitely less inclusion than the other ingredients, you don't want to be just throwing the things in the mixer and call it good.
No,
no, no, no. You do want to take the time to mix it. But also, you know, it's good to see that from previous studies where, you know, maybe they were using other type of mixer, and you know, the equipment nowadays is good to know that we have, I would say, reliable mixers and all that. And you know, as long as all the process and all the qualities follow, we should have a uniform mix for the birth. So
yeah, gosh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then, so beyond the mix time and uniformity, do you think there would be a difference if you pelleted? Because some of those pellets, you know, could be a concentrate and some could be corn.
Yeah. So one of the things that I was reading when I was, you know, kind of visiting some previous work that was done on the mixing side from mm-hmm. other authors and researchers, and they were saying something interesting, that whenever you mix the feed, and obviously the feed goes through the pellet mill, it goes through augers, it falls into the bin. So maybe that transportation from the mixer to the pellet mill, it also adds a little bit of mix time, let's say, not a whole lot, but they were saying that, you know, maybe there's some additional kind of mixing when they go and they fall through the bin, because obviously when they fall into a bin and they go through the pelleting, it's not necessarily a straight process. It kind of falls different from the bin to the feeder screw. So that was some of the things that we're discussing, and you know, assuming that, you should assume that, you know, the pellet in the end should be all the nutrients should be in that pellet.
Yeah. Yeah. So then beyond mixing, the pelleting and the conditioning process on the way, pretty much assuming everything was mixed uniformly, it's just what could possibly break down. Would you say that's the major effect on efficiency, is just impacting nutrients with the temperature?
Yeah. As far as pelleting goes, that's always, I would say that's always an interesting topic, and I always like to hear some interesting point of views and obviously conversations and discussions. That I think that's when you talk about pelleting, you obviously go into the whole pellet quality concept, and that's where mm-hmm. the conversations get very interesting between a nutritionist who, you know, it's his main concern is, you know, the diet. Diet formulation, things about performance on the bird, and the nutritionist has obviously their idea in mind, what the final product, you know, the importance mm-hmm. of the quality of that final product. And then you have the feed mill manager on the other side, where he or she may be interested in, you know, I know I have to, especially we have some cases in integrated meals where they have to work 24/7, but also on the swine side, you know, where they have to finish a specific amount of tons in a week that they have to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if sometimes, and I've seen some of the conversations, they can go anywhere from agreeing, and they may have sometimes may disagree, because, you know, I got to finish this feed. I have to make my goal for the week. I cannot lose the time, and I have to be efficient for what they are asking me. But in that case is where, you know, you can maybe sacrificing some pellet quality. You may sacrificing, like I said, you know, if you want to increase that throughput in the pellet mill, and maybe you know that by increasing the conditioning temperature a lot, you know you're gonna be done faster. But then by doing that, you may be destroying those very important nutrients that are thermostable. So in terms of pellet quality, there's always, I think, like I said, you know, there are a lot of discussions going around pellet quality, and there are so many factors that some are easier to control, and then some are not so easy, that, you know, there are a lot of factors that can impact pellet quality, going from not only the equipment per se, but also the formulation you're using, the ingredients you're using, and all those kind of things. So it's always, and then, you know, going into the cooling process even, you also want to make sure that the pellets are all cooled down, they don't have any moisture inside. So I think as far as the pellet quality topic goes, there are a lot of things that, you know, I think go on, like I said, you know, they definitely goes on between those two point of views.
Yeah. So from all of the points and the steps that you have mentioned today, are any one of those steps more impactful than others, or does each step kind of accumulate to changing efficiency at the end for the bird?
I think every single step is important, but I know that as far as females go, they all have protocols that they follow, steps that they follow, and each facility is different. Also, each diet is different, especially for species too. But I think most of the feed mills, and with the help of nutritionists, they figure out that, you know, if we do for our facility, if we follow these steps and we do it this way in our facility, it will work in the end for the final product, obviously, which is the important part, and, you know, making sure that the feed goes to the birds in the best quality, physical quality they can do, and nutritional quality as well. So I think as far as which one it's more important, I would say that it all falls down maybe to think about, you know, maybe each facility is different and not necessarily what works for one facility will work for the other. But I think it's been, they already have their methods in place that can work. Definitely, there's always room for improvement in some things. And sometimes when I go and visit with Dr. Farnhouse, where he goes to some feed mill facilities, there are definitely recommendations and things that you can do better as far as quality goes. And even, you know, maybe considering changing some equipments to be more efficient and all that.
Oh, sure.
So I think in the end, it all comes together very nicely. And, you know, if there are, like I said, if there's a room for improvement and a facility is willing to do it, definitely, you know, there will be an impact in the final product and on the birds.
So did we cover all the major points that you wanted to hit on as far as feed milling and efficiency, or are there any kind of closing thoughts that you have about the topic?
I think so. Yeah, I think we cover pretty much all of them. Like I said, in pelleting, I think it's one of the things where you can have a lot of discussions, but in terms of the thermostability, I think there's a lot of things that we can try to navigate and understand. Like I said, you know, the pelleting process is very complex. There are a lot of things happening at the same time. And I think we all have, especially the nutritionists, they have figured out, you know, what's the formulation that works for them and what can give them a better performance in the end on the birds. But there's also some things that are definitely still kind of unknown, and we can definitely, you know, navigate it and kind of research a little more on that. So yeah, hopefully we can, you know, we can have some different answers towards some of the things that are still kind of being discussed, and maybe they don't have a specific number, because that happens, you know, that happens. When we're making trials and we have we're taking samples and we're testing a product, it happens where we get the questions like, oh, you know, what do you think would be, what do you think is the best conditioning temperature that I can use, you know, for my diets? And then that's where kind of our answer comes. Well, it depends on, you know, what specific ingredients you're using in the diet. Maybe what's your main goal? Are you trying to maybe increase the throughput as you're pelleting? Or maybe you're having a bad pellet durability and you want to make your pellets a little more durable. Maybe consider slightly increasing the temperature or changing something in the diet that can give you a better quality. But they always ask for specific numbers. They also we get the question of, you know, what's the best pellet quality? Can I have, you know, a pellet quality? Everybody wants a pellet quality of 100%, 90%. And sometimes that's where maybe you can sacrifice a little bit of pellet quality in order, you know, to get some other goals that you have. Maybe not necessarily having 90, but maybe feeding 80% of pellet quality, you're still going to have a good performance on the birds and things like that. So yeah, I think that's one of the things that we get a lot. We always get asked, you know, for specific recommendations that we can give, but you know, like I said, it depends. It depends on some on some facilities, but I think there are good methods in place that we're using as an industry, and I think nutritionists, especially, they're becoming more aware of. Oh well, you know, especially on the mycotoxin side, they're definitely becoming more aware that it's something that they have to keep an eye on and check as far as regulations go and as far as inspections go. So yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Behringer Ingelheim. Health experts bring industry-leading knowledge and expertise to today's poultry producers to help them solve challenging health issues through smart, science-driven decision-making using the best resources available. Probiotech International. Creating the next generation of feed and water additives to improve animal nutrition, health, and well-being. Innovation is in our nature. Visit probiotech.com/EN for more information. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your partner for extra animal performance. Elevate animal performance with Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your trusted ally in excellence. Their high-quality feed ingredients like coated nutrients and fat powders provide ruminants with extra energy, boosting health, productivity, and cost efficiency. Unleash your herd's potential with Berg & Schmidt.
Well, before we wrap up, I want to ask you the questions that we ask all of our guests. And the first one is, do you have a favorite resource that you use in your daily job?
Yeah, there is sometimes when I'm especially on the, I know there are a lot of resources that you can, really good resources that you can find on the poultry nutrition side. Mm-hmm. On the feed milling side, it's a little more sparse, not very straightforward. So
yeah.
If you ever want to read some really basic and really good information on feed milling, it's the Feed Science Technology book. And that's a good resource, very good, and it gives you the explanation you're looking for in a very not diving into, you know, the whole sometimes the whole engineering concept that go with the machine, but it gives you a really, really good concept. And they even talk a little bit more on nutrition as well in there.
That is a great option. Do you have another resource outside of your feed milling and technology, your nutrition book that you've been reading or listening to lately?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a book that is called Resonate. R-E-S-O-N-A-T-E.
Yeah.
And that's a really good book for if you want to prepare and become a better speaker when you do visual presentations. And I think it's actually a popular book. You can find it on Amazon. I think that's a good resource if you're trying to, you know, kind of get a little bit better in public speaking and making your visuals a little bit better for presentations.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great. I'll have to check that one out too. And the last question is what is your best advice to be successful in the industry?
I think the best advice to be successful will be, I always go back to my personal journey, and that all started because I was meeting people, building my network. And you know, especially as a student, sometimes when I was in undergrad, I was really, really, really afraid of approaching professors and industry professionals. But now that I've been a little bit longer into my career, I can see that the poultry industry, especially, it's definitely a small world. Everybody is really, really friendly, and they are all willing to help. So definitely, you know, if you build your network and you talk to anybody, honestly, they are always, you know, either you get a learning experience or they're always willing to help you out. So yeah, I think that would be the advice I would give.
That is great advice. Networking is really important, but also scary. I get it.
yeah, it is. It's been taking me some. It's been taking me some time. I remember when I was a student, I saw the professors and I couldn't figure out how. You know, when I was looking at my advisor and he or she were, you know, they I leave them in a spot during a conference, and then I went around away from like 2 hours, and they were still in the same spot, like they didn't move. Yeah. So now I kind of understand that a little bit better. You know, just the people that you know, and you just try to catch up with everybody, and it definitely takes time. But you definitely get better. You definitely get better.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today. I love talking about feed milling because it's kind of the black box to the nutritionist sometimes, and it's great to uncover someone who works in both areas. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.